listening to West of Middle East, a podcast about Middle Eastern changemakers living in the West. I'm your host, Niaz Kastravi. In season two, we feature changemakers working in and around the field of education. Be it through traditional academia, technology, the arts, advocacy, or movement building. Each episode shines a spotlight on changemakers doing everything from the ordinary to the extraordinary, humanizing their triumphs and struggles and offering a more real narrative of who they are to counter the often sensationalized and misconceived portrayals of these communities in mainstream media. West of Middle East is produced by the Neda Nobari Foundation, an organization supporting social and environmental justice through the arts and education. We cannot simply rely on governments to protect human rights, so we, the people, have to take action. This is a quote by Salil Shetty, the Secretary General of Amnesty International. In its latest annual report, Amnesty says that in the past year, we saw populist leaders across the globe targeting groups of people, labeling them as threats, creating fear, and passing laws that often violate the basic notions of human rights and human dignity. But Amnesty also encourages us not to let this rhetoric erode our vision of a better, more free, and open society for all our communities. I sit down with Dr. Reza Fakhari, an Iranian-American educator and a human rights expert who sits on the board of directors for Amnesty International USA. We examine some of the most urgent human rights issues of our time and learn about how we can be part of the solution. Reza's dedication to human rights is a result of his experience growing up in Iran.
My passion for human rights began in Iran under the Shah's regime. While I was a teenager, I was very much interested in books, sociology books, in the confession of political prisoners. And I had them, and I read about them, and I knew how repressive the system was. I could feel it, the brutality of the system. And so when I was ready to leave Iran to come to the U.S. for my studies, I was arrested for having those books. They were considered banned, and I went to jail for a couple of days, and then I was pushed out of Iran. And I promised myself that one day I would do everything I can for the cause of human rights and political prisoners. And because Amnesty was advocating for the political prisoners at that time in Iran, I said, I'll do whatever I can for Amnesty. So that is the very beginning of it. And when I got to the U.S., I went to school in hard sciences, pre-med, aiming to go to medical school. And then the revolution in Iran occurred in 1979. And because I was always interested in politics, I shifted from hard sciences to social sciences and came to New York to study international relations in the hope of going back and serving my country, becoming a diplomat or get elected to a position in the government. And in no time, that hope was dashed. So I, pursued a career in education, and then I fell in love with it. I felt that, I had a good impact on the students. I was a good role model for them as an immigrant. And then as I got my PhD in international relations and gained a lot of knowledge about the global world that we are living in, and they grasped the sense of interdependence that we have, then, I developed this sense of global perspective and global citizenship. And that's really how it all, began.
And the revolution of 1979 in Iran helped solidify his career path. Reza's involvement with Amnesty International began 18 years ago when he was teaching at a community college.
In the year 2000, at LaGuardia Community College, we established a chapter of Amnesty International. And then we had a conference, a tri-state conference, on speaking truth to power. And the person that got elected, the president of the chapter, eventually, you know, rose up to join the board of Amnesty International, become the treasurer, then the chair of the board of Amnesty International USA. He was my former student. When he was finished with his terms, he approached me and says, could you run for Amnesty board now because I'm turned out? And I said, sure, that's 2014. I ran for the board. I got elected, and I got immediately elected as the vice chair of the board. And he went on to get elected to the international board of Amnesty International. The surprise here is that this student was a fellow Iranian. So this is the impact that I'm talking about, that you cultivate a passion and interest in your seat and serve as their role model and nurture them. And that's the results.
Like so many others, Dr. Fakhari is deeply concerned about the current state of human rights, both in the U.S. and globally.
We hear about democracy being in crisis. There's a book that just came out that talks about democracy in chains. You look at the statistics that Freedom House gives us, and it says that for the past 11 years, we have had significant gains in populist and nationalist forces, especially in democratic states. We can understand it in authoritarian states, but in Western democratic states and here in the U.S. So when you look at the percentage of countries that are free, that has decreased to 45%. And countries that are not free, that is almost 49% and about 30% partially free. So we have had this reversal for the past decade also. And that has brought the onslaught or decline in human rights, civil rights in a number of countries. So it does look bleak, and it's especially bleak in the Middle East and North Africa. So, you know, we are trying to analyze what is happening, and is this a backlash against globalization? Is it a backlash against immigration? And that is the analysis that we are doing now for Amnesty International USA. But here in the U.S., it is the worst. I mean, I don't have to tell you, just in the past few days, the kind of racism that we are witnessing, the kind of erosion of constitutional, political, social norms that we are seeing by this president. So it is bleak, but you know, a crisis is also a moment of opportunity, and we are so emboldened by what we see to resist, to fight, and to regain our democracy.
And there are several crises that look especially bleak to him.
I would say that the situation that we have in Myanmar with the persecution of Rohingya Muslim minority, almost 1 million of them pushed out into Bangladesh. That is heartbreaking for me, especially this being done by a leader who won the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1991. It's just heartbreaking, let's say. Another situation that is heartbreaking is the situation in Yemen. Here you have got 21 million people needing humanitarian aid. You have got a deadly famine looming there, and it's a proxy war by Saudi Arabia, perhaps with Iran. But I think the biggest crisis really has been the refugee crisis. You know, 65 million refugees that have been displaced.
A staggering number, and indeed one of the most heartbreaking human rights crises of our time. Last year, Reza helped pull together a working group at Amnesty International that is devoted to looking deeper at human rights violations in the era of Trump.
So it is a working group that is composed of a core group who are Amnesty International USA board members, staff members, former, information now, and activist leaders and youth members. And then this group is also being advised by an international advisory council of experts. So essentially what we want to do is we want to do a critical analysis of global trends that are impacting human rights, with a particular focus on growing threats to human rights in the context of rising authoritarian populism. This analysis is critical for us. What's happening here? And this is not new. This has been happening for a couple of decades. And so we want to do that through broad-based deliberations involving internal and external people. Once we have that analysis, we want to come up with a set of recommendations regarding what strategies we should pursue to confront the attacks on human rights that we are seeing and how to grow our grassroots membership. And after we do that, we want to assess our impact, what kind of impact are we having? And after that, it is really sharing what we are doing with other human rights organizations, the analysis, the strategies, and forming alliances, and hopefully galvanizing the membership and new members, to fight with us in resisting the human rights violations that we are seeing or some of this ugly phenomena that we are seeing here.
He sees this initiative and the fact that it's based at one of the largest grassroots organizations in the world as promising.
We are the largest grassroots human rights organization in the U.S. and globally. Resistance matters. And that's, I believe, our only option at this point. And Amnesty being the largest grassroots human rights organization in America can make a big impact with analysis, a new strategy, branding, and impact assessment. We hope to grow the organization and make it relevant to more and more members and address issues of concerns to them. The trends that we are seeing have been in the works for the past two decades. And we have books that pretty much talk about them. We have the book Dark Money by Jane Mayers that gives the hidden history of the billionaires behind the rise of radical right in America, especially the Koch brothers. We have another book by Nancy McKean, Democracy in Chains, which gives a deep history of the radical rights plan for America. Another book that covers the rising populism in Europe is Go Back to Where You Came From, which shows the backlash against immigration building up in Europe and America during the past few years. And John Judice's book, The Populist Explosion, also traces the explosion of populism, but he traces that to the Great Recession of 2008, which transformed America and European politics. In America, we have had that, as I mentioned, these books document that this trend has been happening. Especially in the Republican Party, we have seen, you had the Tea Party and then this. But one wonders, here you had Trump winning the presidency by about 80,000 votes and three states. This could have easily gone the other way. And so, one wonders if you had more mobilization, let's say, among Latinos and African-American population that made up for that. It could have been the other way, and this populism could have very well been arrested. But with someone who is so nationalistic and so reactionary becoming U.S. president, it you know, and having a core base, a minority base, that blindly supports him, it's a dangerous moment. It really is a dangerous moment. So here you have U.S. since World War II, we have been building all these institutions of global governance, international law, international human rights. We have been very helpful in building all of that. And suddenly all of those are breaking down. The U.S. leadership is no more. They don't even want him to go to England, you know. I mean, it's just, it's very alarming. And what I fear, for example, take the situation of my native country, Iran. If that situation is not handled well, you could have a war there easily. So, or even with North Korea. And a war pretty much, you know, changes everything and distracts us from all of the human rights work and the rest.
Reza has a much deeper and historical analysis of our current political climate here in America.
It's very complex. My research has involved going back to the founding of this republic and looking, for example, at Jefferson and the founding fathers, and Jefferson buying Quran and imagining Muslims as future citizens of America. And I have looked at the dialogue that they had at that time. So here you have Jefferson using the imaginary Muslims in America in the future to pretty much not create a Protestant nation or a Christian nation, and believing in universal citizenship and religious pluralism. That ideal of America as a pluralist nation goes back to that time. They pretty much established a framework of integration and universal citizenship. That obviously has been a work in progress because it didn't include Native Indians, it didn't include African Americans, and we went through so many. We went through civil war, we went through the slavery, civil war, reconstruction, lynching, and all of that. And then obviously the civil rights movement. But I do believe that America has been a work in progress and advances have been made. I think what is happening now, at least in my limited understanding of it, is this, that you have got a diversity explosion here, that the white population is going to become a minority. I think that is a big anxiety. And what I see today is really arresting immigration and reversing it. And the more people of color who emigrate into U.S., the more they form the base of Democratic Party. And the Republicans do not want that. Therefore, if you listen very carefully in the past couple of weeks, they don't want more immigrants coming, especially immigrants from Africa, Haiti, or, you know. And so that, I think that concern of, I'm not even optimistic about DACA for any legislation to be passed. I think this is not going to happen. But we saw that, for example, in terms of temporary status for the Haitians and for the Salvadorian, that I think the rationale here is arrest immigration and reverse it. Even legal immigration, they want to reverse it. So there is that anxiety of loss of white power here. I think that is one thing. The other thing is maybe that is related to globalization. When before globalization took off with a vengeance after the end of the Cold War, you know, you essentially had a secure middle class here. There was a social contract. Most whites were doing very well. After globalization and everything going global, nobody is secure in their jobs. The social contract is off. And you had this shock of Great Recession in 2008. You know, they are anxious what is happening to the middle class, to the working class. Therefore, you're seeing this kind of assertion of sovereignty, nationalism, breaking of trade agreements, bringing jobs back here, that insecurity. And I think that is defeatist because you're living in a globalized world. We are highly interdependent, especially economically. So rather than thinking thoughtfully about that and how best we can equip our citizens to compete in the global marketplace, we have got this reactionary actions that are more counterproductive and actually undermine a sustainable democratic globalization system that we could have helped to build. So, as I mentioned, it is complex, and the solutions that are being offered are not the real solutions either. As I have been teaching about globalization since 1992, I have been emphasizing that the kind of globalization that we have is not sustainable. It's not democratic. It is leading to this widening inequality. What you need to do is to make it more inclusive. So you create stakeholders globally in the game of globalization. And so you don't have the backlash. And terrorism is one of the backlashes against globalization.
This analysis is tied directly to the fact that by all accounts, if trends continue, the U.S. is set to become a majority-minority country where the predominant racial class is no longer white. Reza is also a beloved educator at the City University of New York.
You know, for many years, for almost 28 years, I was in academic affairs at CUNY. Began as a lecturer, instructor, and moved up to become a full professor, tenured, and then joined administration. What I'm very proud of at CUNY is the programs that I built. The programs included honors, international studies, and global and civic engagement, and co-curricular programs. These were all aimed to expand the students' consciousness, to make them think globally. And these programs, the students that participated in them, I could see the change that we are. I mentioned the case of Sharam and, you know, becoming the board chair, but there are many, many other examples of there. So the greatest pride that I take is the kind of compassionate engagement that I have with the students. And this is not only students that agree with me, but also conservative students, because I taught for more than 30 years at Fordham University. And I would get highly diverse students, you know, politically. So that has been a source of pride to me. In this new position, which is not in academic affairs, and it is as vice president of continuing education, workforce development, and strategic community partnerships, we serve about 25,000 students in this area. And it involves a lot of external relations. So I work with business, industry, elected officials, community-based organizations. So it is very interesting that before in academic affairs, I was raising the global awareness of students. In this new position, I'm local. I'm in the community. And I'm looking at Brooklyn, and which is resurging economically with a lot of job growth, a lot of innovation, a lot of energy. But you look at the communities across Brooklyn, the disparities are amazing. We have some communities that I'm working at that the percentage of the residents not having a high school diploma is as high as 40%, that the level of poverty is more 30% or more. So now my calling is in my borough of Brooklyn, where my college is located, and we are the only community college in Brooklyn, what can we do in terms of economic empowerment? And enabling these residents to get their high school diploma, get credentials, get a college degree, and join the middle class ranks. So this is what I'm passionate about, from global going local. But, you know, some of them are in this kind of situation because of the global impact, because a lot of these jobs may have been outsourced, and therefore they have to get more training, more education to be able to survive and succeed.
I ask Reza to elaborate on his views about globalization.
I have to say that I'm not against globalization. I actually think that overall globalization has done more good than bad. I mean, think about it. When I was in graduate school, we were talking about sweatshops, about how we were exploiting the underdeveloped world and how bad globalization was. And then now you open your eyes and you see that many of those countries, China, Vietnam, they are joining globalization and they are prospering, you know, and they are rising to middle class level. So in graduate school, you know, we were told that people in those countries could not do sophisticated manufacturing or advanced technologies because they were somehow, the implication was they were somewhat inferior. Now, as William Grider has said in his book on globalization, that any of them can do the most complicated manufacturing. So that kind of stereotype that we have is shattered. You can have iPhone made in China or in Vietnam, and there is no problem for them to understand all of the intricacies of it. And so I think, as I said before, that globalization can be beneficial to everybody. But the thing is, the lords of globalization that are benefiting disproportionately from that have to see that this is not sustainable. And you can't have 2 billion people in the world making less than $1 a day and 3 billion making less than $2 a day. It's just not sustainable.
In the course of his impactful career, Reza finds much to be proud of.
I came from a family in Iran. My parents didn't have any formal education, no education at all. So I'm a first generation student, the only son coming to the U.S. And all my parents wanted was for me to achieve the highest degree I could. And thankfully, I did that before they passed away. So for me, having achieved that as an immigrant has been, a source of pride. And every day in my college, which has students from 142 national backgrounds and they speak 73 different languages, to be that role model for them that you could achieve as well, that's very satisfying. I'm also proud of my heritage as a Muslim. I've never renounced that. I'm a proud progressive Muslim. And I want to show to my fellow citizens in America that you can have a Muslim that can be at a senior level, senior leader in a college, and be engaging with people of any other religions or any other race, and to create that dissonance that they don't see a Muslim as the other, but a Muslim that is here in your university for 30 years, serving the institution, helping the students, and now helping the communities. That is a source of pride. I want to show to them that, hey, here is a Muslim. And I don't want to say good Muslim, but, you know, a Muslim that, you know, a real Muslim, not the 0.1% of Muslims that are extremists and violent, and they have pretty much tainted us all. At Amnesty, obviously, the work that we have done has been a source of pride. This is an organization that has a rich history and has made a lot of difference. And now at this crucial juncture, when everything is in danger, we are rising up and saying we won't take it and we want to fight it and we want to mobilize our membership. We want to grow. We want to study everything. And we want to form alliances. So that is an exciting moment. It's depressing to see what is happening here and globally. But at the same time, it's really, really energizing.
But his experience as a youth in Iran is something that he goes back to again and again as a turning point in his life, something that made him fully determined to pursue his career as an educator and an advocate. I ask him if he's comfortable talking about what exactly happened.
It really was frightening to live under Shah's regime. So I exited Iran in 1973. That was 6 years before the revolution. But 73 probably was at the peak of repression in Iran. I couldn't even talk to my parents. My dad would always look behind the curtain to see if there was any kind of listening device. It really was awful. And for a kid who was curious, and I was reading the books that I was referring to, the sociology books were by Ali Shariati. I mean, this was a Shia religious scholar, progressive Shia scholar, you know, and these were not harmful books. They were not called to action. They were just, you know, very interesting books. And reading confessions of political prisoners, I just wanted to know what was happening. Why were they dissenting from the regime? I wanted to know what that. Again, I wasn't doing anything that was violent. It's just reading that. And then suddenly, you know, my home is invaded and all these books are taken. And I'm told, you know, come to your city. I was in Tehran getting ready to come to the U.S. And when I get to the train station in my city, I'm arrested and taken by Sawak to jail. And the lucky thing was, you know, that my father knew the head of Sawak in my city, Semnan, and said, hey, he's the only son. He's leaving the country anyway. Why don't you just kick him out and he'll leave tomorrow? And that's exactly what happened. They gave me the approval and kicked me out. But, you know, that experience of tyranny, living under a tyranny, many, many years later, I said, I witnessed it firsthand. So when I hear someone coming from a repressive background, I can identify with that. When I talk about human rights and how bad it is, because I know how the condition can be and how they can suffer. So coming, you know, to the U.S. and then hoping that a revolution would change things and changing my major so I can go back and then having that disappointment, and then during Iran-Iraq war, not being able to go to Iran for 10 years because I may have been called to service. So it has been really tough. And I think it has really made me more determined to fight for human rights for everybody, to think globally, and to do my part to make this world a better world.
So what is Reza's advice to those who are looking to join the movement and stand for a cause?
There are so many human rights organizations in America now. Amnesty is not the only one. We are the only grassroots organization. There are campaigns, there are programs, there are letter writing, there are lobbying. If they can simply educate themselves what the human rights communities are doing, by going to the website and finding a cause that they feel passionate about. And I think this is part of our working group that we are working towards, is to really reach out to various segments of Americans that we haven't reached to and see what are the issues that they are concerned about and if we can address those issues. We are broadening the definition of human rights. It's not only political and civil rights, no, it is economic rights. Women's rights is human rights, no. Discrimination, you know, that's also a human rights. Climate is a human rights, you know. So for them, there's so much out there that you can get involved with. It is a matter of educating yourself and finding what resonates with you, what you feel passionate about. But get active. It really matters. Civic engagement matters. You can make a difference. And the problem is just get that hooked. Just if they can get active, it can be so satisfying and rewarding. It is the problem of getting them involved initially, and after that it takes off.
It's true. When you look at the onslaught of human rights violations, the intensity with which they seem to be happening, and the continued prevalence of injustice and violence, it can seem overwhelming and make us feel hopeless. But then again, when we see how people and communities have historically come together, both nationally and internationally, to resist and stand up to tyrannical leaders, in the aftermath of the Trump election as an example, we can't help but to recognize that we are the individuals who collectively have the power to turn things around. It merely requires that we see ourselves as powerful. You've been listening to West of Middle East. You can hear more episodes about changemakers from the Middle East diaspora at westofmiddleeast.org or check us out on iTunes. If you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes. This podcast is created by the Neda Nobari Foundation, an organization supporting social and environmental justice through the arts and education. Our engineer is Rick McRae of Conscious Studios. Music is composed by Loga Ramin Torkion and Azam Ali. And I'm your host, Niaz Kasravi. If you want to share your thoughts about this podcast or have ideas for future seasons, email us at comments@westofmiddleeast.org. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.